Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. And by Penn Medicine.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. The first thing I do every morning is step on my scale. It's not my favorite habit, but it's become second nature. Since having my second child, I've been about 25 pounds overweight. It bothers me, and I also have sleep apnea, and the extra pounds are making that worse. So for 7 years now, my daughter just finished second grade, I've tried to lose those 25 pounds. And guess what? They haven't budged. I mostly eat healthy foods like fruit and yogurt for breakfast, a big salad for lunch, but then 4 p.m. hits.
I always get so tired at this time of the day. And then what I really want is something sweet. And of course, I had these chocolate-covered pretzels in my desk. Why do I have chocolate-covered pretzels in my desk?
For me, food is about joy, having meals with friends and family. But then I get lots of cravings. I eat because I'm tired or bored or I'm trying to put off a task. I count and I track my calories. I work out a couple of times a week, reluctantly.
It's a little bit after 6 in the morning. I'm going to go exercise. I'm not thrilled about it. I never wake up and think, oh yeah, I should exercise, that's going to be fun.
I switch it up. I swim, I lift weights, and sometimes I go to this huge free group workout.
I am motivated!
And yet, here I am. Lots of people have the same kind of struggle. Maybe it's an extra 25 pounds, maybe it's an extra 100 pounds. Millions of Americans are overweight or obese. And that weight has come with a wave of serious health problems: heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes. On this episode, we'll look at how we're dealing with the fallout. What really changes people's behaviors? What do doctors and nurses know about weight? One big culprit in obesity is what we drink. Sugary beverages like soda are the single largest source of added sugars in the American diet. Now, some cities, for example Philadelphia, are trying out a new approach, soda taxes, which raise drink prices to discourage buying. The tax is controversial, and one big point of contention is whether it ends up hurting poor people. If you want to find ground zero for that debate, North Philadelphia is it. It's one of the poorest neighborhoods in the city, with lots of health challenges and obesity. It also has the most soda drinkers in the city. The tax is a bit over a year old now, so Liz Tung went to see how it's hit people's waistlines and pocketbooks.
Medina Food Market sits on a crowded block filled with pawn shops, nail salons, and dollar stores. Above it, the L train rumbles by every few minutes. And at the deli inside, the lunch rush is just getting started. The shelves are lined with candy and chips and cans of Goya beans, and along the far wall, a refrigerator case is filled with soda.
Root beer, Sunkist, Fanta, Welch's strawberry soda, Mountain Dew, orange.
And at least a dozen more flavors, plus punch and iced tea and energy drinks. The selection is huge. But the shop's owner, Edward Medina, says soda isn't selling like it used to.
The store is low now. It's very slow.
A distributor who's come in to drop off some stock confirms what Edward has to say.
It's hurting the small guys. They are not making money.
His name is Isam Latif. He works for a company that distributes iced tea and says he's seen falling sales inside Philadelphia and increased business just outside the city limits where there is no tax.
They are not making money. Why? Because the customer, they go buy from outside Philadelphia. And these guys, the store owners, are losing money.
Philadelphia soda tax doesn't just cover soda. It includes anything with added sugar, from energy drinks to sweetened kombucha. For example, Isam says the iced tea he sells has gone up 30 cents per bottle. 2-liter sodas are up by a dollar, and gallon jugs of drinks are up by $1.92. As we're talking, a woman with a stroller and blonde hair pulled tight into a ponytail comes in. Her name's Erica Burgess, and today she's buying a Sprite and a Coke. But she says this isn't a regular thing for her. Not since the tax passed.
Yeah, I noticed it. That's why I don't buy it that often.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I don't buy it that often.
So you buy it a lot less now?
Yes, a lot less. I say about maybe once a month anymore, and that's all we'll have.
How much did you used to drink soda versus now, you think?
Every day.
Every day?
Every day.
And now you can only buy it once a month?
Yes.
So it sounds like you're not a fan of the soda tax.
No, not at all.
Actually, it seems like everyone at this shop hates the soda tax. And so does the American Beverage Association. They represent industry giants like Coke and Pepsi, and they've poured millions of dollars into fighting the tax. In fact, in May of this year, the Beverage Association argued its case before Pennsylvania's Supreme Court. No decision has come down yet, but the group has continued to push out its message that the tax is hurting small businesses and poor neighborhoods. Public health officials, on the other hand, say that poor people are the ones that could benefit the most.
I love Philadelphia, but we are rock bottom for health, and we have been for a very long time.
Cheryl Bettigol heads up chronic disease prevention at the health department, and she says that of the 10 biggest cities in the U.S., Philadelphia is number one in obesity, number one in diabetes, and number one in early death from heart disease. And Cheryl says all of that is linked to the fact that Philly is also the poorest big city in the country.
There's no getting around the fact that poverty is the single most important factor. I mean, it is the core reason for those outcomes.
There are a lot of reasons why being poor is linked to obesity. People without money don't have as much access to healthy food and good health care. Plus, there's the fact that people living in poverty are stressed out, and junk food, including soda, can offer a little lift in their day, which Cheryl says the soda companies have figured out.
The predatory marketing of sugary drinks is absolutely a social justice issue. You know, you might decide in the morning that you're not going to have a soda today, but by the time it's 3 o'clock and you're tired and hungry and you've seen, 27 ads for soda and they're all, looking really attractive, you might grab a soda.
Cheryl says the soda tax is one way of making that decision a little harder. She emphasizes that that isn't its main purpose. The official purpose is funding education programs for lower-income kids. But the possibility of cutting soda consumption, especially in low-income areas, is a major plus. And she says it seems to be working.
What we're seeing so far, and it's very early days in terms of the data, looks really good. And, when I talk to friends who see patients in inner-city neighborhoods, they're also describing a dramatic drop in sweetened drink consumption.
That's supported by a recent study that surveyed almost 900 people in Philadelphia just before and after the tax passed. Lead author Yichun Zhong says that in Philadelphia,
The odds of the daily consumption of sugar soda dropped by 40% within the 2 months after implementation. And this drop is accompanied by an increase of the odds of daily bottled water consumption.
Compared with no change in nearby cities like Trenton and Camden, which are just across the river in New Jersey. Now, the study only looks at short-term effects. We still don't know whether those changes will last. But the findings square with what health officials have seen in places with similar taxes. For example, in Berkeley, California, sales of sugary drinks fell by 10% in the year after it passed its own tax.
Taxing high sugar, high fat beverages and foods can promote change at the population level.
David Sarwer says this is a good thing. He heads up the Center for Obesity Research and Education at Temple University.
The amount of sugar that we see in a regular soda is really staggering, and we don't think about it in terms of being the quantity that we really is. That if we took an equivalent amount of sugar and put it in front of somebody and said, I'd like you to eat this sugar, most people would choose not to because it would seem way too sweet and way too unhealthy, yet we're readily able to drink these things.
Case in point, let's say you grab a nice frosty 20-ounce bottle of orange soda on a hot day. Along with your refreshing dose of citrus goodness, you're also consuming about 72 grams of sugar, which, to put it in perspective, is the equivalent of, say, an entire teacup filled with sugar. Now imagine doing that every day, even a couple times a day. Cheryl Bettigol, the public health official in Philadelphia, says that's exactly what a lot of people do.
Soda has become something that's gone from being an occasional treat to something people consume all day long. And that constant sugar in the bloodstream drives insulin production in the pancreas, which makes people hungrier, makes them gain weight, and makes it really hard not to keep drinking that same sugar.
Which, over time, can contribute to obesity and diseases like diabetes. That's why a lot of public health officials are so excited about the soda tax. Of course, that's public health people. People in the beverage industry, they feel a little different.
I think that by any measure, this tax has been a public policy disaster.
Anthony Campisi is the spokesman for the Coalition to Stop Local Food and Beverage Taxes. The group includes local businesses and is funded by the American Beverage Association. One of their biggest talking points is that the soda tax hurts the very people public health experts say it should help. People in low-income neighborhoods.
It's cost nearly 1,200 local jobs. It's devastating supermarkets, corner stores, and bodegas, particularly in poor neighborhoods in the city.
Those numbers are based on a study funded by the American Beverage Association. But Anthony says the findings are sound and could mean that small neighborhood supermarkets end up having to close.
And that, over the long term, has to have a negative public health impact. If there's no place to buy, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables and all the other things that, like, a supermarket provides.
Cheryl Bettigol, the public health official, says city data says otherwise. And, of course, to be fair, we should point out that the city has its own stake in this.
The industry has been putting out lots of reports that jobs are being lost. But the jobs data and the wage tax data do not show that. Jobs in the beverage industry and in the grocery industry have, in fact, gone up, as has wage tax.
But Cheryl says all this bickering and back and forth might not be a totally bad thing, so long as it gets people thinking before they reach for that next soda.
The one plus of the beverage industry's multimedia push on this is that it is the single most effective public health campaign I have ever seen.
For The Pulse, I'm Liz Tung.
A bunch of American cities now have soda taxes, and they are also becoming more popular around the world. France has a soda tax, so does Hungary, Portugal, and India, and many more places. What are we learning about the global impact? I talked about that with researcher Xu Wen-Ang. One of the places she looked at was Mexico, which has had a soda tax since 2014. Xu told me the tax resulted in a roughly 10% price increase for soda.
So for a 10% price increase, there was, by the end of the second year, almost a 10% purchase reduction.
Wow. So if a soda was $2 before, it would now be $2.20, and that made an impact.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So is that surprising? I mean, that doesn't seem like a whole lot of money. Do we know sort of like what's the pressure point for people when they start considering, maybe I don't need this?
Yeah, this is a great question. So in the case of Mexico, we actually saw shifts from away from the taxed beverages, but increases in the purchases of bottled water. So bottled water sales actually increased quite a bit. So actually, from an industry standpoint, they're not necessarily losing money. In fact, my collaborator at the Institute of Public Health in Mexico also looked at the employment numbers in Mexico within the beverage industry and found that there was no change in employment figures in the Mexican beverage industry.
What about, there's always conversation with these taxes that they unfairly target people who have less money. So if I have a fairly decent income, you know, 20 cents more or less, or even 25 cents, you know, that's not such a big deal. But is this unfair to people with less money?
What's important to keep in mind is that the lower income households tend to also carry a much higher burden, both in terms of health, but also in terms of the poor health outcomes on their pocket. You know, to see a doctor, it might cost roughly the same no matter what your income level is, but proportionately for a lower income person, the cost of seeing a doctor is going to be much higher, right? Because you have less income to begin with. So when you consider these sort of healthcare costs that are associated with diabetes, heart disease, for example, that have been found to be highly related to consumption of sugary beverages, this tax is actually what we would call progressive. It's actually helping the lower income individuals and families, because in the long run, they're going to be benefiting more from reducing their consumption of these types of unhealthy beverages.
Has any place considered taxing more than just sodas and sweetened beverages? You know, why not tax gummy bears or Kit Kats and Snicker bars?
Well, actually, in Mexico, there was also an 8% tax levied on what they called non-essential unhealthy foods. And likewise, there was a reduction in the unhealthy food purchases.
What do you think is next for soda taxes? Is this going to become a global movement that really spreads?
I think it has already become a global movement, and there's momentum on this as more evidence gets built up, given the different experiences of countries and cities around the world. And all of this is going to help shift populations in terms of their overall social norms around the types of beverages and foods to be consuming. Because, you know, at the end of the day, the industry is also responding to what consumers want. And so if you can change what consumers want, that will also then encourage the industry to change what they produce.
Xu Wenang is an associate professor in the Department of Nutrition at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. The health impact of obesity is serious, which is one of the reasons medical professionals are so quick to make us step on the scale. They take that number, along with our height, to calculate the BMI, body mass index. It's weight in kilograms divided by height in meters squared. A BMI between 25 and 29.9 will land you in the overweight category. A BMI of 30 or more is obese. This is not a perfect tool by any stretch. Lots of critics call it bogus, like if you're really muscular, you will have a high BMI, and having a normal BMI doesn't mean you're healthy. But bogus or not, it's the benchmark that most doctors and insurance companies use when they're trying to predict and prevent future health problems. Medical professionals have to step on the scale too and think about their own BMI. Here's a nurse who has had to deal with that. She lives and works in an isolated town in western Alaska.
My name is Barry Levin. I'm a nurse practitioner and I work in Bethel, Alaska. I have always struggled with weight since I was a child. One of the reasons is because my father was very obese. It became like a family affair to do things like go out and have ice cream or eat pizza. And he would bring things home. And it was more of an event, like a big deal to be eating things with him. It was a connection. So I think one of the biggest reasons why I started gaining a lot of weight is because when my father died, I was only turning 10, so 6 weeks shy of my 10th birthday. It became a comfort for me. It was a way to cope, and it was a way to be connected to him. And a lot of times that was the only way I could cope, was to find something that to eat. Obesity is a very large problem, no pun intended, but it's a very large problem in the state of Alaska in general. It seems to be a bigger problem for the native population. And in Bethel, I take care of people who live out in the villages, and they're not always able to get the food that they need that we call healthy, because in the stores, very little is available. They have to get their groceries shipped in, and sometimes that's very expensive.
Okay, I'm in Bethel, Alaska, and the gallon of milk is $7.29.
Look at the price of milk here in Bethel, Alaska. $8.99 for a bottle of milk.
So right now I'm overweight, but I was obese, and I lost 72 pounds in 6 months. So before I lost the weight that I lost, I always said to my patients with regard to weight that I couldn't really speak to what's the right thing to do because I wasn't successful at it. For me now, I have the authority to say, because I've lost the weight and I can say, look, I did this, you can do it. I'm just one human being talking to another human being, and I'm not anybody special. You're just the same as me. It also makes a difference that I'm not thin, because if I was really thin, it's very hard for people, knowing, because I was obese, I know how it feels to be on the other end of somebody who's really skinny to say, you should do this, you should do that, you should do this. And I'm like, yeah, easy for you to say, you don't have to worry about it. So now I can say that with not only authority of like, look, I know what you have to do because I did it. I also know what a struggle it is. And I also know that I'm still working on it. So I can really identify with them. And I think that it makes them feel more empowered.
Barry Levin is a nurse practitioner in Bethel, Alaska. Abby Holtzman produced this piece. We're talking about obesity and what we're doing to deal with the fallout. A lot of people feel like their doctors judge them for their weight. And maybe that's true. Fatima Cody Stanford is an obesity medicine specialist at Massachusetts General Hospital, and she even caught herself doing that once.
I've been taking care of a woman who was one of my internal medicine patients for approximately 3 years. She was a patient that did have severe obesity.
So they worked on lifestyle factors like physical activity and diet. But the weight did not go down. Then Fatima ran into her patient at the grocery store.
And it was right as she was about to check out, basically, you know, pay for her groceries. She, of course, sees me and she says, oh, Dr. Stanford, it's great to see you. You know, we began to have a quick conversation. And she noticed that I was surveying her grocery cart and said, see, Dr. Stanford, I have been doing everything you've said. And when I did survey that grocery cart, it was really picture perfect, really all lean proteins, whole grains, fresh fruits and vegetables. And then I began to realize that here I was questioning whether or not she had been abiding by the advice that we had focused on over the last 3 years, recognizing here that she had been doing so, but her body was just resistant to those lifestyle changes.
Fatima says we have lots of biases when it comes to people who have weight issues.
We often make judgments really quickly about their willpower and determination, assume that they must be lazy, slothful, unable to adhere to plans and regimens.
What do we know about what contributes to obesity?
So we know it's a multifactorial, multidisciplinary disorder. A lot of it regulated by how the brain controls weight. There are environmental factors that contribute to weight, biological factors, maternal and paternal developmental factors that contribute to weight, medications that are prescribed that can cause weight gain. There's been all of these changes over the last 30 to 40 years to try to reduce calories, put people on certain diets. And despite all of these things, what we've seen is a significant proliferation in obesity rates.
Fatima says many doctors still buy into the old calories in, calories out adage. But she says treating obesity is way more complicated than that.
We're learning about things such as like the gut microbiota, which is the bacteria in one's gut, and how that differs in persons that are lean versus those that struggle with their weight. And studies are being done currently here at Harvard where we're taking the gut microbiota, meaning the bacteria out of the gut of lean individuals, and putting that in the gut of persons that struggle with weight. And we're seeing weight changes without making any other modifications, meaning weight loss occur.
You say somebody has obesity. Most doctors I have talked to say somebody is obese. Why do you use that term?
I'm so glad you brought that up. This is one of my soapbox moments that I'll step on for just a second here.
Go ahead.
Recognizing that the patient has the disease of obesity but is not defined by it. We do not call, and I will not call someone an obese child, obese adolescent, obese patient, or use terms like morbid obesity, as these are highly stigmatizing and they cause patients to have less of a desire to seek care. And those patients that are less likely to seek care are those patients that need our care the most.
How does race and class come to play when it comes to obesity?
What we do know, if we look at both the adult and the pediatric population here in the United States, is there are huge disparities regarding the prevalence and the treatment of obesity within racial and ethnic minorities like myself. I'm an African-American woman. We do know 40% of the U.S. population has obesity, but we know that 60% of African-American women have obesity. So that's a stark contrast, looking at the rates of, let's say, obesity within the African-American population compared to whites, or even compared to Hispanics, where they kind of are in the middle ground in terms of their prevalence. Some of it, you know, might be, you know, access to healthy foods, access to spaces where physical activity is encouraged and you feel safe in that environment. I think that those are parts of the puzzle, but not all of the puzzle. What we see, for example, for African-American men is that as they climb the socioeconomic ladder, their obesity rates increase, which really kind of is paradoxical to what we would consider to be the case with how we think of, you know, what the relationship will be between obesity and socioeconomic status. So I think it's a bit more complex than, you know, we would like for it to be, which makes my job harder, but it also makes me even more enthusiastic about trying to find solutions to treating not only obesity, but issues related to race and class and obesity itself.
Fatima Cody Stanford is an obesity medicine physician at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. She told me more doctors are getting special training to learn about treating obesity. There's also a push to get rid of the term obesity altogether, to call it ABCD instead. Adiposity, that's fat-based chronic disease. Doctors usually recommend diet changes and exercise to encourage weight loss, but when patients have a lot of extra weight, there are other options like medications that control appetite or surgery. We heard from one woman who opted for that path, and she sent us this recording.
Hi there, my name is Kelly Drake. I'm 47 years old. When I turned 40, my body started to change dramatically and hormones started to take a nosedive. I put on a great deal of weight and I reached a highest weight of 293 pounds. Very uncomfortable with myself, very unhappy with the way I looked and felt.
After a lot of doctor's visits, tests, and psychological evaluations, Kelly was approved for a vertical sleeve gastrectomy. During that surgery, about 85% of the stomach is removed so that it then takes the shape of a tube or sleeve. It's been a bit over 2 months since the surgery, and Kelly says she's lost 43 pounds.
My clothes are starting to fall off of me and I need to go clothes shopping soon. As far as what I'm eating, it's a lot of protein. Well, primarily protein, not a lot, because my sleeve doesn't hold a lot. It's about the size of a large test tube now is what the size of my stomach is. Any protein I eat, I have to chew very, very, very well for a long time. And I am happy to say that my sleeve likes Caesar salad. There is a lot of challenges that come to play when you get the weight loss surgery. It's not a quick fix. It's definitely not a quick fix. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of tears. There's a lot of struggle, but the weight is definitely coming off. I'm eating considerably less food. And I feel a lot better.
Thank you, Kelly, for sharing that story with us. We're talking about weight on The Pulse. Weight reduction and healthy eating are big factors in treating chronic illnesses like heart disease and diabetes. For certain high-risk patients who don't have easy access to nutritious food, some insurance companies have decided that it's worth it to cover prescriptions for food the same way they would cover prescriptions for drugs. Nina Feldman has more.
This is the sound of 65 gallons of soup.
Yeah, from scratch, with celery, onions, crab meat, sweet potatoes, and you blend it all together.
That's Cliff Rogers. He's a volunteer at Mana, a meal delivery service in Philadelphia. Cliff and more than 100 volunteers show up every day to make and package over 5,000 meals for chronically ill people all over the city.
You would have to find them.
In every corner of this large industrial kitchen, volunteers are packing and sealing medically tailored meals into little trays like school lunches. Every meal is color-coded according to a specific diet plan. So, say someone has cancer and has a very low appetite. Those meals will have a lot of calories packed into a small amount of food. Someone with kidney failure will have a meal plan low in phosphorus. Diabetes, low sugar.
Technique, it's all technique.
MANA's a big operation. The nonprofit covers most of its costs with grants and donations. But a couple years ago, the program caught the attention of health insurers, too.
The traditional ways of dealing with some diseases are not working as well as they could.
That's Bill George. He's the CEO of an insurance company in Pennsylvania called Health Partners Plans. Bill says the idea of food as medicine has made sense to him ever since he was a kid. Growing up, Bill's dad had type 1 diabetes, and the whole family ate whatever dad ate.
And all the food was weighed. We had a very restricted diet, no carbs, no sugar. And my mom was not a very imaginative cook, so we virtually had the same thing every night. Hamburgers, no bun. She would count the beans. We'd have a slice of iceberg lettuce and a glass of water.
Fast forward a few decades, and Bill's at an open house learning about MANA's meal plans. That's when it clicks. He could pay to make sure people are getting good nutrition instead of paying for them to go to the hospital.
If you have someone who has a chronic wound that will not heal, you can have it surgically closed time and time again at thousands and thousands of dollars in costs. But basically, if you feed them an appropriate medical diet, the wound will heal.
Back in 2015, Bill signed MANA up as a provider for patients on Medicaid, the same way his insurance company pays a health clinic to provide care. Since then, people on the food plan have seen a nearly 20% decrease in their health care costs. Health Partners Plans reaches out to its members with chronic illness, many of whom are food insecure, to see if they're interested. I hopped on the delivery truck to see a week's worth of breakfast, lunch, and dinner get dropped off.
Should I put it in the kitchen?
Yeah, you can put it on the table right there.
Feliciano Pagano is 48. He's got a shaved head and tattoos on his forearms. He used to work as a DJ before he got sick and couldn't lug around his audio gear anymore. He shares a small apartment with Scrappy, his English bulldog.
He's bilingual. When you got a dog that turns on the TV on his own with the remote control and changes channels, we got a problem.
After Feliciano was diagnosed with congestive heart failure, the doctor recommended that he exercise and eat a low-sodium diet. But he kept going back to the food he knew.
Fried pork, pork chop, Geno's, a lot of potato chips, anything that I felt like craving, cheesesteak, I will eat.
He tried to change his diet, but he didn't quite know how.
I was like a chicken with the head cut off. I didn't know how to deal with it, what not to eat. Sometimes I used to go to Subway to get me a healthy sandwich, and sometimes the sandwich had greens, things that I couldn't eat, so I used to get upset and just walk out.
Veggies like spinach and broccoli are full of vitamin K, which heart disease patients are often told to avoid.
There are days that I didn't feed myself because I didn't know what to eat.
And then one day, someone from Feliciano's insurance company called him and asked if he'd like to receive 3 healthy meals a day delivered to his doorstep for free. He unpacked the bag of meals to take stock.
Turkey noodle soup, not bad.
Feliciano says in 2016, he estimates he went to the emergency room 5 or 6 times.
That's a sad. Something different.
But since he's been getting the meals, he hasn't been to the ER once.
And the little fruit cups, the peaches.
He's lost about 12 pounds, and he'd like to lose more.
Let's just say my swimming trunks falls on me now.
When I visited, Feliciano's meal plan was set to expire soon. The insurance company pays for just 6 weeks at a time. Nutrition counseling is available for members, but not required. Feliciano said he does talk with dietitians over the phone about how to cook and buy nutritious food on his own. Still, without the meal delivery, he wasn't sure he'd be able to keep up with this diet.
To be honest, I will try. But sometimes you want to cheat. And that cheating once, it continues.
As long as the meals keep showing up at his door, Feliciano says he doesn't cheat. He's excited about the food.
Especially the oranges. That's the only thing I share with Dummy.
Long-lasting behavior change often takes intensive coaching and serious shifts to your home environment and habits. There's not much research on how people's health is affected after they stop getting medically tailored meals. That's why back at the insurance company, CEO Bill George says this service needs to last longer than 6 weeks for some. And for a very small percentage of people, a meal plan might need to last indefinitely. Bill said his company would be willing to pay. You wouldn't prescribe insulin for a diabetic, he says, and then cut them off after a few weeks. Overall, though, Bill said the goal is to get people to be self-sufficient.
For this to be successful, the member has to want to change. And if you're not willing to change, it's a waste of your time and it's a waste of our time. It's not going to work.
Enough people are counting on it working that other insurers are signing up too. And in California, the state Medicaid program has enrolled a few thousand people in a pilot study to see if food as medicine can work there. For The Pulse, I'm Nina Feldman.
This story is part of a reporting partnership with Kaiser Health News. In recent years, sugar has become a dietary public enemy. It's in so many delicious foods, candy, donuts, cake, ice cream, but then it's also added to stuff like tomato sauce and bread. Eating less sugar is hard for us as individuals, but food makers are also having a rough time. Alan Yu has more.
You know the pushback against sugar has reached critical level when you see even big candy makers like Nestle signing on to give people low sugar options. Right now, when I go to the vending machine for a Snickers bar, when I check out the nutrition label,
250 calories, 27 grams of sugar, that's more than half the sugar I should eat in one day, so, and that's before I have any ice cream.
Several candy makers have pledged that by 2022, half of the individually wrapped candies will have no more than 200 calories. All sorts of food makers are thinking about ways to cut sugar.
Everybody finding what they need? Everyone's getting all their ingredients? Okay, so you guys know what to do.
At the Culinary Institute of America, master baker Richard Coppridge is preparing his students for a future where people still want tasty treats.
The main premise is we're going to exchange some of the sugar and or the chocolate chips with varying sugar substitutes. Okay? Yes,
there are several alternatives. Stevia, Splenda, Maltitol, and there's also sugar-free dark chocolate and sugar-free milk chocolate. Taylor Freer is one of the students gathered around in her chef's whites. She's never had to replace the white sugar in her recipes, but she's up for experimenting.
Especially that in my family we have a lot of people who have diabetes. So learning this and applying it so then they can actually have their own birthday cake would be nice.
Chef Coppedge asks me to do a taste test, and he also offers me a way out.
So if you need to not ingest it, we got a spit bucket. Because you don't want to get full, because you have to try six different cookies. So if you ate one, that's six different big cookies. That's like 12 ounces of cookies. You got to try them all.
Sure. I'll eat half of each.
All right. Again, whatever you don't want to eat, you can just drop in there.
It's not going to be that bad.
The cookies taste similar, but they do look different. Some end up drier, some are more moist.
When you replace all the sugar, you have to deal with the consequences of how it's going to change the dough. And it's literally going to make the cookies go way out horizontally, unless you add more flour.
Chef Coppedge says it's a tricky thing to get right. When chefs and manufacturers work to give us low-sugar alternatives, they're up against some powerful human conditioning. Our brains respond differently to food that we like, and we like sugar.
We're looking at pictures of all the good types of foods. So things like chocolate chip cookies, ice cream sundaes, pizza, cheesesteak.
That's Ariana Chow. She's a researcher at the University of Pennsylvania. Her team scanned people's brains as they looked at different pictures of unhealthy food.
And we contrast those to both low-calorie foods, things like apples, broccoli, carrots.
When we look at the high-calorie stuff, the reward centers in people's brains light up in scans. Scientists are still trying to figure out why that is, but biologist Paul Breslin says that preference goes way back. Our ape ancestors ate mostly fruit, and that means sugar. Breslin teaches nutritional science at Rutgers University in New Jersey. He says we're probably meant to get most of our calories from sugar.
This is true of chimps, it's true of bonobos, it's true of gorillas, and it's still today true of us. Now, we left the forest. We're the only ape to have left the forest. All the other apes still live in the forest.
We're not in that environment anymore, but our brains still reward us when we eat sugar.
We are meant to eat sugar in the same way that we're meant to breathe air and we're meant to sleep and we're meant to drink water. And they're all acting on a reward center.
But the difference is now most of us don't have to work as hard to forage for food, and we have a near constant supply of sugar. In the environment we're in now, there are so many things around us making our brains light up. So we have internal forces driving us toward sugar, and outside forces tempting us too. We almost have to outmaneuver our brains.
I don't keep any sweets in my house at all.
That's Kimma Cargill. She's a clinical psychologist and a sugar lover.
I don't even keep any sugar. That's not to say I don't ever eat sweets or dessert. I just make it where I have to go somewhere and buy, you know, one serving of ice cream or go get some cake. But if I have it at my house, forget it. I'll be, you know, eating it every night.
Kimma is a professor at the University of Washington, Tacoma, where she teaches psychology.
What I'm talking about are highly designed, sophisticated ingredients that have been developed by food scientists who are They're almost wizards. When I am teaching undergraduate students about this, usually all I have to say is Krispy Kreme donuts, and everybody just gets it.
She says treats like Krispy Kreme donuts and Ben & Jerry's ice cream, that food is deliberately designed with a ton of sugar to appeal to us.
In a way, we might think about these highly engineered foods as being kind of a threat to willpower.
Alan Yu reported that piece. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. For many of us, keeping weight at bay is an everyday struggle, and we have to find something that works. I asked people on social media about this and heard about all kinds of different approaches: mindful eating, intuitive eating, high-fat diets, or this one.
My name is Andrea Karabetsis, and I'm from Phoenix, Arizona. And my diet du jour, as I like to call it, is the four-hour body, where you cut carbs, sugar, and any dairy from your diet. Therefore, you have no fun.
Another popular approach is fasting for portions of the day. Alana Gordon looked into this trend.
Mimi Dexter L. has not had breakfast in over 2 years.
It is 7:06 in the morning. I am about to get ready for work.
Dexter L. lives in Phoenix and works in marketing.
And right now I am smelling the wonderful aromas of my dear mom making breakfast.
Dexter L. is a big proponent of what's called intermittent fasting. She's even got a blog and Facebook page.
I'm smelling onions, mushrooms, eggs, all this wonderful breakfast food, but I will not be having it.
There are several ways to do intermittent fasting. Some don't eat anything a couple days a week. Others eat every other day. And then some eat during a specific window. For Dexter L., that's between 5 and 10 p.m., which means at lunchtime...
Instead of heating my lunch in the office, I'm heating some tea. White tea, actually.
Dexter L. says she had tried a bunch of different diets and exercise approaches.
But, you know, usually would lose the weight, gain it all back, and then some.
Then, a couple years ago, she realized things were really getting out of control. She was 44 years old, and at 5'5", weighed 237 pounds. At first, Dexter L. says her doctor was wary of the fasting approach. But he saw her weight and bad cholesterol dip.
My numbers just improved in every area. So he eventually kind of came around to it.
So are a number of other doctors and scientists.
Our ancestors before the agricultural revolution undoubtedly had to go extended time periods without food.
This is Dr. Mark Mattson. He's a professor at Johns Hopkins and also heads the neuroscience lab at the National Institute on Aging. He says for most of human history, we needed to be able to fast. Those who couldn't function efficiently on an intermittent diet would die. Mattson is going beyond these evolutionary theories. He's studying the effects of intermittent fasting on the brain and the body.
What defines fasting is a switch in the source of energy in our bodies from glucose that's released from the liver to mobilization of fats from fat cells.
So instead of burning sugar for energy, you start burning fat. Sounds great if you're trying to lose weight, right? But let's slow down a minute.
It really is not something that I would encourage people to do.
Nutritionists like Stella Volpe at Drexel University is not on board. She worries fasting could be harmful.
It's not sort of teaching them good, healthy eating practices and behaviors to be somewhat consistent in their eating behaviors and their meals and snacks throughout the day.
Plus, Volpe says there haven't been any long-term studies on people. Most of the research is in animals. Still, for fans of intermittent fasting, they say it's working for them.
It is 2:11 p.m. Just got off a conference call a little bit ago.
Mimi Dexter L. would welcome more science to back up what she's doing. But she doesn't see any reason to stop, even when fasting has its moments, like in the middle of the afternoon.
Right now I'm feeling a little tired.
She hasn't eaten anything in 17 hours.
I'm still going to push through.
And before Dexterell knows it, it's time to eat.
It is a little after 5 and I'm home and it's time to break my fast and I haven't decided exactly what I'm going to break it with. I'm looking in the refrigerator. There are many options.
She settles on some papaya. Then she heats up some leftover stew. Later on, she snacks on some popcorn and has a couple pieces of candy. And that's it.
It is 9:20 p.m. and it really wasn't too hard. So we start all over again tomorrow.
For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Alana reported this story in 2016. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhorov, Alan Yu, and Liz Tong. Mike Moscarelli is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Alex Stern is our associate producer. Tanya English is our editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care. Penn Medicine supports The Pulse. Some of us live for the future. But what if tomorrow is too late? That's why today at Penn Medicine, their breakthroughs are helping to change lives. Healthy cells can now find and eliminate cancer cells. Focused ultrasound is taking the place of brain surgery to correct essential tremor. And vision is being restored using a genetic treatment. That's why your life is worth Penn Medicine. Learn more at PennMedicine.org.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at PartnersWithAPurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.